Hey, I'm Johanna Wagstaff.
And hi there, I'm Rohith Joseph.
And we're asking for 10 minutes of your day to go through the 10 things that the UN recommends we can all do when it comes to climate change.
Please don't leave.
No.
And also, the things aren't new.
We are just wired to not do them.
We promise you to help you figure out your brains, and you and your people can make better choices to combat climate change.
10 Minutes to Save the Planet is available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight.
They were there to provide food and hope, and a UN official tells us aid workers with World Central Kitchen were following the Israeli military's rules when they came under fire and seven of their colleagues were killed.
Irreplaceable. A friend of one of the workers who died in the strike shares her memories of a woman she says would have done anything to help a person, or in this case, an entire people, in need.
Audio visuals. Harvard astronomers are elated to share the device they created so people who are visually impaired and blind can experience the upcoming eclipse.
Farewell to Mellonville. Comic actor Dave Thomas remembers his late friend and SCTV collaborator Joe Flaherty, who he says they thought of as the godfather of the cast.
Caking up a fuss, a baker in England is not alone in feeling frustrated that his town council is not fixing the never-ending line of potholes on Daventry's roads, so he's cooked up a new kind of protest.
And tying up a loose ends. 5 years after the brazen heist of a golden toilet from a British palace, the thief finally pleads guilty because he never really had a handle on the situation. As it happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that proves there's no restroom for the wicked. The Israeli government says it was a tragic mistake. Last night, multiple Israeli strikes hit three trucks belonging to the aid group World Central Kitchen, killing seven people. The trucks were driving on a designated route and had cleared their movements with the Israeli military. World Central Kitchen has now suspended its life-saving work in Gaza, and two aid ships have left the strip carrying hundreds of tons of undelivered food. James Elder is a spokesperson for UNICEF, who just returned from Gaza. We reached him in Geneva.
James, you were just in Gaza. You were at World Central Kitchen just last week. What did you see there? What kind of conversations did you have with the team?
I saw a lot of people who are the people that who World Kitchen are serving coming down from an area where they've been cut off from the world in a heavily bombarded area, lacking food, surrounded around that Shifa hospital, desperate situation. And they come, and there's psychologists, and there's people with warm meals, and there's people to give them guidance about where on earth they might possibly go. So just it's this immediate relief that they provide to people, nourishment, but also care and just someone to talk to.
Having seen it up close and knowing that you have teams there too, what did you think when you heard the news?
Look, it's heartbreaking. You know these people. You know what they do. You know they've traveled around the world, you know, with the best possible intentions to do whatever they can in a situation that is continuing to spiral out of control. So, look, I was heartbroken, but to be perfectly honest, Neil, I've been heartbroken since those horrendous attacks on the 7th of October, and then every following day where an average of 80 girls and boys are killed. So yeah, there's a sense of overwhelming sadness, senselessness at this loss of these, you know, beautiful young people, everything they're trying to do, and anger, because this is so utterly avoidable. They did everything right to be targeted like that, despite doing every single protocol to ensure that Israeli forces knew exactly who they were and where they were. And yet we have seen, you know, many, many incidents of civilians and innocent people being killed in this war.
What do those protocols entail, James? Because we know they're operating in what are known as deconflicted zones. Their trucks clearly display World Central Kitchen, the charity's name, and they have to clear their movements with the IDF. What other protocols are in place?
That's the big one, the clearance. The clearance takes days. You give 48 hours notice, and then even then, you once you finally get clearance and there's a coordination on the ground, they know exactly your coordinates, exactly the time you will leave, exactly when you will go. Often you stop on that route at a holding point where, again, you get another clearance. So every single thing is absolutely precise in the same way, and I'm sorry to be graphic, but in the same way that those three, not one, not two, but three rockets hit those vehicles. So, yeah, I mean, unfortunately, we've been saying, Neil, for a long, long time, nowhere is safe in Gaza, and everything speaks to there. These bleak records that keep being broken, children killed, highest number of people facing catastrophic hunger in two decades of keeping that, highest number of United Nations colleagues killed in any war since the UN was created, and now international aid workers killed.
What kinds of conversations, and maybe these were happening at the kitchen when you were there or with your teams as well, to deal with the dangers while still knowing that you're supposed to be protected?
Oh, it's a very good question. Look, I mean, I think there is a sense that you have to have faith in the systems that are there, your own security, and then, of course, you know, these elaborate processes that I've outlined, you have to have faith in those. If you sit there thinking of those all the time, you'll be utterly debilitated. You know, when I, having just come back from 2 weeks in Gaza and lying there at 3 o'clock in the morning and hearing these immense bombardments hour after hour and the building shake, there is nothing to do at that moment other than to feel a great deal of sadness and empathy for children and their mental health as they hear this again and again, but to have hope that the system somehow is going to work. Otherwise, you know, you just debilitate. You simply won't function. So I think that these wonderful young people who'd given everything in their work probably had a camaraderie and an energy, and they had faith in the system. It's the only way to do this day in, day out.
We know World Central Kitchen has had to suspend its activities. Some 240 tons of aid had to be returned to Cyprus. What is this going to mean for other aid operations, but more importantly, the Palestinians in Gaza who are desperate for any sort of aid still?
Well, exactly. I mean, the reason the World Central Kitchen's work was so critical and the reason UNRWA's work as the largest UN agency there is so critical, UNRWA, who had been delivering 50% of food aid to the north and are now blocked from doing that, all this is so, so vital because Gaza now has the largest percentage of a population anywhere to have this most severe rating of a nutrition crisis in 20 years. So when I was in the north where the malnutrition crisis is the worst, I'm seeing babies that are paper thin. Now I'm seeing babies that I don't know if they will survive another day. And some of these babies who are in hospitals, they're only there because their family home was bombed. And when an ambulance went to see any survivors, they also found a malnourished child there. So the criticality of this moment, you know, is absolute. Now, of course, it's right that they pause to understand what on earth has happened. But of course, people in Gaza don't have hours, don't have days.
Do you have any sense from what you're hearing and seeing from your contacts? You know, we've hearing pressure from governments where they've lost people in this attack. We know a Canadian and Australia and the UK as well. We're hearing leaders release these statements and say, you know, they're pressuring Israel. Do you sense there'll be any shift?
I honestly don't know. I know I was in Gaza just over a week ago when the Security Council called for a ceasefire, and the sense of relief on the ground in Gaza was immense. You could feel it. Literally, as I said, the idea that parents thought, my God, I can go to bed with my little daughter tonight knowing there'll be no bombardment, knowing we will wake up. And that hope, unfortunately, from that ceasefire request has, you know, been drowned out by bombs. So I don't know what other pressure will occur, but I know the people of Gaza are running out of time.
James, thank you for your time.
Pleasure, Neil.
James Elder is a spokesperson for UNICEF. We reached him in Geneva. Zomi Frankum was one of the 7 World Central Kitchen workers who was killed in the Israeli strikes in Gaza. Soraya Baget was her friend and worked with the organization in Egypt. We reached her today in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia.
Soraya, when did you last correspond with Zomi?
I last corresponded with Zomi a little less than 2 weeks ago. She once was going to be back in Cairo, and we had wanted to meet and catch up.
So this news today, you know, I just spoke with James Elder with the UN, who said he was just at the kitchen and was stunned to hear this news as well.
Yeah.
How did you find out?
I woke up early to many messages asking me if I'm okay and expressing, you know, sorrow at what happened to the World Central Kitchen team, because I had, you know, volunteered with mm-hmm. them and I had known Zomi. So, but I did not know that she was killed, actually. I immediately sent her a WhatsApp and felt, you know, this big ache in my heart when only one check went through. And I was just praying that her, you know, she's out of coverage or didn't charge her phone. I had hope, and I immediately went to Twitter to figure out what is this attack that people are asking me about or asking me if I'm okay about. And unfortunately, I saw her. I saw her dead body along with Damien, and a very, very heartbreaking, difficult moment.
That's Damien Sobol, another of your friends, another World Central Kitchen employee. I'm very sorry, Soraya, for your friends and former colleagues.
Thank you so much.
What did she tell you about why she wanted to do this work in Gaza in particular?
Zomi was made out of light. Zomi was a natural-born giver. She loved World Central Kitchen, and she loved the team and the family. She really enjoyed what she did with so much commitment. So this is the person she was. She wanted to go and was always ready to go wherever she was needed, regardless of the personal risk. And I think she was very moved by the suffering in Gaza and really wanted to be there. She had started with WCK as a volunteer, actually, when she met some of them in Guatemala while she was on vacation. So this is a woman who, on vacation, wanted to volunteer and feed others.
Did she feel that she was risking her life? I mean, there are risks, obviously, in a place where a war is unfolding. But did she feel that she was putting her life at risk? Is that something you talked about?
I think she was very safety conscious, but she was also very duty bound. And she wanted to be on the ground. I remember she was working with me. I was volunteering with her in Cairo. And she was very good managing things remotely, but she always wanted to be on the ground too, because the idea was to serve better, to have more impact. And she was very, very concerned about delivering as many nutritious, culturally appropriate meals as possible and as fast as possible. She was always focusing on that. I have to tell you that I saw her last video from Deir Barah, and that smile, she looked so happy doing exactly what she loved to do. And was excited. She would always be very excited when she would reach a new goal, such as like opening up and setting up a new central kitchen, because the way they used to work is that they would try to go into different areas and set up their community kitchens. And I see that video, and I've played it so many times today to try to give myself comfort that she was still doing what she loved doing so much. And I see a huge smile at her succeeding to do this.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says this was unintentional, that this happens in war, and that there will be a full investigation. How are you processing that response, Soraya?
I'm in deep shock. I'm in deep shock that this has happened, especially that World Central Kitchen had liaised and had informed of its movements. They had also placed signs on top of the vehicles. I am deeply shocked and deeply saddened. I have a hard time believing that such wonderful people could be targeted, particularly that it's important to note that World Central Kitchen never discriminated when it came to their life-saving relief efforts. So they would never take sides in a conflict. They actually set up kitchens to also feed the Israelis who fled the north of Israel because of the airstrikes coming out of the south of Lebanon through Hezbollah. So it's difficult for me to process that this could have been intentional. But I joined so many in demanding accountability for this senseless killing of these wonderful people.
You mentioned Damien as well. What can you tell us about him?
Damien was a bit shy. But once you got to know him, he was funny. He was full of life. He was very kind. He always had a smile. I remember I posted on my Twitter this beautiful picture that I love of both of them. During a lunch break, I had to drag him to come to eat lunch because he was so fixated on his computer and the work that he was doing for World Central Kitchen. She also, Zomi was also the kind of person who was very committed. In fact, I would see them working through their weekends and long days with so much commitment and never complaining.
What were you planning to do when you reconnected in person?
I was going to take her out to the sushi place that she invited me to in Cairo. She loved sushi like me. And one of my favorite memories of her is that a dinner we had when I was able to, steal her finally on a moment when we had finished work. And we had this dinner together where we had the heart to heart. And she was talking about leaving to go home soon. She was happy with the work, but she was at that point very exhausted because she had to deal with the earthquake in Turkey. And she had been at that point when I met her. She had come straight from Morocco, where she was helping provide relief efforts and food for the survivors of the earthquake. Yeah, she was happy to come back to Cairo. That I remember for sure.
Soraya, thank you.
No, it is I who want to thank you very much for paying tribute to these remarkable souls that we lost yesterday.
Thank you, Soraya.
Thank you very much.
We reached Soraya Baghat in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. He was Count Floyd, a TV host dressed as a vampire who was so confused about his role that he howled like a werewolf as he introduced an Ingmar Bergman movie on Monster Chiller Horror Theater. He was the knee-slapping showbiz hack Sammy Maudlin and the long-suffering news anchor Floyd Robertson. And he was the obnoxious, unscrupulous owner of the SCTV network Guy Caballero, to name just a few. Over the course of a single episode of SCTV, Joe Flaherty would transform himself again and again. The only constant was that he was hilarious. The comic actor and writer died yesterday at the age of 82. He was born in Pittsburgh and was a Second City stage performer before becoming one of the original cast members of the pioneering sketch comedy show. He would go on to memorable turns in movies like Happy Gilmore and Back to the Future 2 and TV's Freaks and Geeks. And he remained close friends with his longtime SCTV castmate, Dave Thomas. We reached Mr. Thomas in Los Angeles.
Dave Thomas, what do you remember about the first time you met Joe Flaherty?
I saw him on stage before I actually met him.
Oh, yeah.
And I saw him pull some pretty remarkable comic rabbits out of his hat as he performed on stage at Second City. And his choice of a name... Joe always used to try to break up the cast by entering as a character with a name that was, well, he's an example of one of them, Hudgy DeRobertus. And when you come in and you say, what's your name? He's a Hudgy DeRobertus, and the audience laughs. You know what I mean? You've already done half the work of a sketch, of winning the audience over just by saying your name. So, I mean, he was pretty good. And I thought he was probably the best actor in the cast at SCTV and did some incredible stuff. If you look at his body of work over his career as a comic actor.
And a writer, too, on SCTV.
Oh, God, yeah. And I mean, Joe and I wrote sketches together. And when you're in the trenches with somebody writing sketches together, you really get to know the person really well. Because there's a kind of an intensity to the work. And I remember when Joe and I came up with this parody of Fantasy Island, which was not just a parody of the television show Fantasy Island, but also a parody of the movie Casablanca, and also inside that, a movie parody of Road to Morocco, the Hope and Crosby movie, and also a parody of The Wizard of Oz.
Sure, why choose one?
Boy, that was fun. And it was a really wonderful writing experience of working on that with Joe. Yeah. And but, you know, Joe was a pioneer. We all kind of looked at him as the sort of, the Corleone godfather of this SCTV cast. And when he did his Godfather parody, he played that character. And that was an inside joke, but it was also a kind of a tribute to him and who he was, to the cast and to all of us.
How did he feel? He's one of those folks who a lot of people assume is Canadian. Andrea Martin is another one. He's not. Did he feel like an honorary Canadian? How did he feel about that designation?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, when Global dropped the show and we went to Edmonton, mm-hmm. and it became a CBC show and an NBC show, Joe probably loved Edmonton more than anybody. And he went back there many, many times. And, you know, Joe loved Canada, and he was originally from Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
But he certainly was an honorary Canadian in all of our minds. No question about it.
Were you guys able to keep in touch over the years? When was the last time you had a chance to chat?
I talked to Joe last week.
Oh.
And, you know, I was supposed to go see him this week, and I went to Hawaii with the family, and now I'm riddled with guilt that I did that instead of going to see him. But, you know, when I got off the plane, I got a text from his daughter, and it just said Joe passed away. And it was horrible to have all the laughs and all the fun and all the years of working together reduced to three words: Joe passed away. I stared at my phone in just shock and disbelief, that not because I wasn't expecting it, but because of the kind of finality of everything about the man that I'd grown to know and love had been reduced to three words. Ah, that was awful.
Oh, I'm so sorry for your loss, Dave. But you have such incredible memories and recorded memories in addition to the ones behind the scenes.
Yeah, and our phone calls, we would joke about old movies and reminisce about embarrassing moments that happened behind the scenes of SCTV. You know, it was a strong relationship, and it was a good one. We called each other Dingo. I can't remember.
Dingo with a D?
D-I-N-G-O. I think it was from that Australian movie where, I can't remember the actress, but the thing
Meryl
guy
Streep.
Is
Meryl
Ivy.
Streep. She's an up-and-comer called Meryl Streep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So where Meryl Streep is going, the dingo stole my baby. And we always thought it was funny. We started calling each other Dingo at that time. And and then one of the great honors for me was that his daughter, who I know, but not anywhere near the way I know Joe, who was with him when he was ill, she started calling me Dingo. And that made me laugh.
Oh,
it was so sweet. Anyway, it's a big loss to comedy, a big loss to us personally, and I think a big loss to Canada that one of their adopted American sons has slipped away.
For those of us who didn't get to know him behind the scenes, as you said, you know, working in the trenches, writing together, what do you want the world, our listeners, to know about the kind of person Joe Flaherty was?
Joe was relentlessly innovative, idiosyncratic, and sometimes dysfunctional. He was never on time for anything. And if you wanted to be sure Joe was on time, you had to drive by his apartment and pick him up. That was the only way to guarantee that he would be on time. And usually he would make you late too. But when he got there, boy, did he collaborate. Boy, did he participate. And I loved him dearly as a friend and also as a comedy legend. So I'll miss him.
Thanks so much, Dave.
Sure.
Take care. Thank you.
Dave Thomas was a longtime friend of his former SCTV castmate, Joe Flaherty. We reached him in Los Angeles. Joe Flaherty died yesterday. He was 82. If you lived in England and you wanted a heist done as loudly and ineptly as possible, you knew who to call. Jimmy Sheen. You needed someone to drive a car through the window of a convenience store and drag the ATM away? Jimmy was your guy. Or maybe that seemed too complicated. No problem. Jimmy and the boys would just blow the ATM up without moving it and grab whatever cash they could. Or maybe you wanted some tractors from inside the National Horse Racing Museum, a job so pointlessly risky that it would definitely get you sent to prison. Jimmy had you covered. He would steal those tractors and go to prison, which he did. And from prison, he just pleaded guilty to an art theft that was characteristically artless.
I'm really shocked. I can't believe there's a £1 million toilet that's been stolen. All gold. I wanted to go on it.
I can't believe they managed to get into the palace as well. Like, I thought security here would be tight locked. So, yeah, it's amazing that someone's been able to access it and be able to take it. And it's not small, is it?
That is quite shocking. I have to admit, I'll go back. It'll be the highlight. We were there at the crime scene. Someone stole a £1 million toilet. That's an amazing story, I think.
From a 2019 Sky News report, shocked tourists reflecting on a crime that had just been committed at Blenheim Palace. Someone had stolen the work of conceptual artist Maurizio Cattelan, a fully functioning 18-karat gold toilet, subtly entitled America. A toilet that was actually worth £4.8 million, or $8.2 million Canadian. The thieves had just wrenched that 103-kilogram toilet, that is about 227 pounds, out of the floor, causing a flood, and they hauled it out of the palace somehow without getting caught. Until last year, when four men were arrested and charged, and today, one of them, Jimmy Sheen himself, pleaded guilty and admitted to stealing America. The toilet has never been recovered. And knowing him, I'm guessing Jimmy Sheen smashed it with a sledgehammer or drove over it and then sold the pieces. But for a while there, he was sitting on a gold mine.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart MacLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
It's a small rectangular device, and in a video, you see the user slowly move a cover over its light sensor, which sounds like this. That device is part of the Light Sound Project. That team has been distributing them so that space enthusiasts who are part of the blind and low vision community can use them during the upcoming eclipse. Allison Barilla is the project lead and an astronomer at Harvard. We reached her in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Allison, describe those different sounds we heard there in that clip.
Yeah, so what you're hearing when you hear that high flute sound is kind of bright sunlight, and then it dims down to a clarinet in the mid-range as the moon starts to eclipse the sun. And then in totality, you'll just hear a little bit of clicking, and that clicking even slows down. And then the reverse happens as you come out of totality back to bright sunlight.
And how many of these devices have you distributed so far ahead of the eclipse?
We've built 900. We're thrilled. We were aiming for 750 and we got 900 out. So we're just really happy.
Are they distributed for free? Is there a cost associated?
Yeah, the project is completely open source and we were funded by several, NSF and Simons Foundation and others. And so we were able to donate these, across the U.S., Canada and Mexico for free.
The recipients must be, you said you were thrilled, but they must be thrilled too, right?
We've gotten really, really positive responses and a lot of excitement. So we're really happy about that.
What kinds of things are people telling you? And they haven't even used them yet.
Yeah, I think just even demoing it, the overwhelming thing that I've heard is just like in 2017, a lot of people felt left out, that they weren't able to participate in a way that they were interacting with the eclipse in a meaningful way to them. And so I think this device is one step toward giving blind or low vision individuals access to real data to the eclipse live.
You came up with this along with your colleague, fellow astronomer Wanda Diaz-Merced, who is blind. As you were putting this together, just take me inside the conversations you were having. What was she telling you?
Yeah, I approached her because I was thinking about lab accessibility. I manage the labs and telescopes at Harvard. And so I was thinking, you know, are our labs accessible to a blind student? And so I was talking to her, knowing she's blind and knowing that she uses sonification for her research. So taking data and using and interpreting it with sound. And so that's something I hadn't really thought about ahead of time. So having that conversation was kind of, you know, I was learning and then I got really excited about it too. And then we were talking about the eclipse because the eclipse was happening that summer. So we started thinking, how do we make this eclipse accessible? And so we decided to build this tool, which we call Light Sound, and try to get it out. And in 2017, we only got 3 out, but now we have 900. So we're definitely stepping it up.
Absolutely. The 3 people who did have it, how did they react in those moments as they heard the eclipse?
Yeah, so I had one of the devices and mm-hmm. I was in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. So Wanda was going to be in South Africa with her students. And so she was really hopeful that I could get the sound streamed to her on the internet so her and her students could react. And they were thrilled. They were, she sent pictures of them, you know, cheering and just really happy. And the other two were in Kentucky. We had one at the Kentucky School for the Blind and the other was in Moorhead State University. They were, you know, focusing on trying to collect the data so the devices can connect to a computer and you can save the data to analyze later or sonify later. And they were also streaming or just projecting the sound to their events, which, again, really good feedback. But we did want to improve on the sound quality. So the newer version has a MIDI synthesizer, which allows us to assign instruments to it. The original prototype didn't, and it wasn't quite as pleasant to the ears.
How have you been able to scale up from that original 3 to hundreds and with better audio quality? Who has made this possible? I mean, you've been doing this at Harvard, certainly, but not on your own.
Soleil Hyman, she was an undergrad at Harvard, and now she's a graduate student at the University of Arizona. She joined the project in 2018, and she's actually a musician, too. She's an astronomer, but she's a musician. And so she really helped us think about the choices we're making in terms of instruments. And then for this eclipse, we also partnered with Elliot Richards, who's an engineer here at the Center for Astrophysics. And he helped us design a printed circuit board version of the device, which makes the assembly just so much easier. It drastically improved the amount that we can make in any one given setting.
How long does it take to make one of these?
Yeah, the wired version took about 3-4 hours. And this new version, you know, a person never having soldered could make it in 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. And we had one person racing to make them and made it in 5 minutes. So it's,
oh, wow.
Yeah, you can make them very quickly once you get used to it.
Did you have sort of an assembly line? I'm imagining your lab taken over. I mean, this is not the kind of DIY project that most people are doing at home, right?
Right. Yeah. So we traveled to places. So we were at University of Texas, Austin. We had one at Harvard University, Maker Spaces. We were all over the country running these workshops. So, you know, different labs and universities and people, you know, join our workshop. And having no experience soldering, we kind of teach them this new skill and they assemble the devices. And then they kind of learn new skill. We get the devices made. We're able to give them back to the community. It's a really nice setup that's worked really well for us. And we couldn't have built this many without the community input that we had. It's been great.
You know, some of our listeners who may be just hearing about this might be wondering if they're still able to get their hands on one of these devices. Is that still possible?
We don't have any more to ship out, new ones, but they are all across the United States, Mexico and Canada. So there's certainly, I think there's some in your area. You can go on our website and there's a map of all the locations. So depending on where people will be, you can kind of zoom in and see what's nearby and hopefully they could join an event that's hosting these. So we have them at, you know, schools, libraries, museums, they're kind of all over the place. We're also hoping to host a streaming event where people can log in and listen as we kind of project the sound from different sites along the eclipse path. So people can also engage that way as well.
How would you rate your excitement level for the eclipse?
You know, I couldn't be more excited about the eclipse, but now it's the weather that you got to worry about.
Right.
The predictions are changing every day, and it's a little too soon to say for sure, but we're getting close, so it's starting to get real. So the nerves are kicking in now.
If it's not the kind of weather you hope for, how do you prepare yourself for that?
I did get to see the 2017 eclipse, so I've seen one, and so it would be devastating not to see the next one. But I understand that, you know, you can't get everything. But that's why I chose where I'm going. I'm going to Hot Springs, Arkansas. I figured if it's cloudy, at least I'm in a national park. I'm in Hot Springs. I can enjoy the day.
So it's passion, but it's your work at the same time.
Yeah, I'm trying to, you know, do all the work we can, and then the day of, I just want to enjoy it. I don't want to do anything else. I just want to take it in.
Allison, really good advice, and great to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Allison Barilla is an astronomer at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. We reached her in Cambridge, Massachusetts. There are all kinds of ways to protest, but very few of them are delicious. Take Daventry, England. Some people there have a bone to pick with the town's leaders. One of them has taken to putting up anonymous protest signs, dubbing himself Daventry Banksy. Others have gone to complain at council meetings. But Ben Welch is a baker, so his objection has taken the form of dessert. We reached him in Daventry, England.
Ben, pastry and politics are colliding. What have you called your creation?
I've called it the Daventry Pothole.
What does it look like?
So it almost resembles a pothole. It's a croissant-based pastry filled with Oreo cheesecake, Oreo crumble, and an Oreo tire shape, just to mimic a pothole.
Yeah, the tire is sort of stuck in at an angle off the at the top. Are you hoping when people bite into it that it makes them forget about how angry potholes make them?
Yeah, I'd a better taste rather than getting their tires stuck in an actual pothole.
What's the response been so far to your creation?
Smiles, lots of laughter. Yeah, it definitely puts a smile on people's faces.
What kind of problem is there? You know, how bad is it, I guess, that it gets to the point where you decide that your bakery should take up this cause?
I mean, the potholes are often referred to the Grand Canyon at the moment, so I thought I'd take a stand and create something a bit unique to it.
How long has this been going on? Has this always been a part of Daventry's identity?
It's slowly starting to become Daventry's identity. It's just been an awful experience the last couple of months, really, with the heavy rain and the flooding. It's just caused more and more potholes.
There's someone going around calling themselves the Daventry Banksy. They're putting up signs that say things like, "Welcome to Pothole City," twinned with the Grand Canyon. What kind of reaction are those signs getting? How do you feel about them?
I mean, I think the signs are a very unique and hilarious way of telling the council to actually come and fix our potholes. But they are spending money on someone to pay down the signs rather than actually fixing the pothole.
There's one that says "Hold on tight, Route 66 potholes." Are you the Daventry Banksy? We should ask. Is your activism going beyond pastries?
Unfortunately, not. I mean, I wish it was, but I admire whoever's doing it.
The West Northamptonshire Council tells the BBC, quote, "We understand the frustration. We are working to prioritize and complete works as soon as possible," end quote. What's your sense? Does a statement like that leave you feeling confident that those holes are going to be filled?
Probably the opposite direction, really. I feel like that's just an excuse to try back down the media, really. I wish I could actually have faith in them, but from the past few, I think it was a year or 2 years now since we moved to the WNC, it's just got worse and worse, and Daventry feels more overlooked than actually being looked after.
Have you driven, you know, when you're out driving, when you've left the bakery, what kind of impact? It sounds like it's a lot more than just a nuisance. I mean, anyone who's driven has driven over or hit a pothole at some point in their ride, in their lives, but why has it escalated beyond nuisance?
It's just getting more and more worse. You hear more and more stories around Daventry that the costs of people replacing their tyres both alloys as well. I mean, prices are ranging between £200 to £700 recently, and at this current time with the cost of living crisis, it's getting harder and harder for us people in Daventry.
So you're thinking you're going to make the pothole pastry a regular instead of just a special offering?
100%. It will stay on the menu even if all the potholes in Daventry are actually fixed, which I highly doubt, really.
Either way, they're staying on the menu. It's a part of history now, whatever happens.
Exactly, yes.
How much do they go for?
So let's go for £4, which I think is quite reasonable, and a lot cheaper than a pothole repair or an alloy replacement.
Fair enough. Ben, good luck in your fight.
Thank you.
Ben Welch is a baker in Daventry, England. What happens in Vegas will continue to stay in Vegas, but if you're happening in Vegas, you can't stay at the Tropicana in Vegas anymore. After 67 years in operation, the Landmark Hotel and Casino is no more. The slots went silent today, and the site is slated for demolition to make way for a Major League ballpark. But the Tropicana will always hold a special place in the history of Sin City, as we learned when Neil spoke to Michael Green, a historian with the University of Las Vegas and a member of the board of directors of the city's Mob Museum.
I grew up in Las Vegas, and I was born a few years after it opened, so it's always been there. So as a Las Vegan, I feel a great nostalgia, the idea that this place I'm used to seeing won't be there. As a historian and a historic preservationist, it pains me, but I also understand that the Tropicana is an older property. The owners see an opportunity, and that's part of the heritage of Las Vegas as well, reinvention and tearing down and rebuilding.
And money.
Money does enter into this situation, yes. Doesn't it?
Just a little. And at the time, in 1957, when it opened, I didn't know it had been referred to as the Tiffany of the Strip, the most expensive hotel ever built in Vegas at the time. Speaking of money, there were also links to the mob, to organized crime. Frank Costello, the gangster. I know, it's going to be shocking to a lot of people. We are blowing the lid off of a lot of Las Vegas secrets right now. Frank Costello, the gangster, had a role, certainly, in the early days of the Tropicana. What was that role?
Well, it's always hard to figure out exact roles because there's an old line that organized crime saved a lot of money on stationery. They didn't like to write things down. Yeah. But the people who were behind it, one was from the Fontainebleau in Miami, which normally meant there was some tie somewhere to Meyer Lansky. And the main guy, he was called Dandy Phil Castell. So usually if there's a nickname, there's probably a mobster. And in this case, Costello, as the so-called prime minister of organized crime in New York, he's kind of overseeing things. And about 3 weeks or so after the Tropicana opened, somebody shot Costello. It was not fatal, but he goes down on a street in New York City. And the police come to check him out. And in the process, they check his pockets. And there's a piece of paper. Remember what I said about writing things down? You don't write things down. So on the piece of paper were some numbers. And it turned out they were the numbers that the Tropicana was about to report to the state as its revenues for the first 3 weeks. And when Frank Costello has that in his pocket before the state of Nevada has it, I think it says something.
Was the word skim written on it, or was it just a thinking?
It should have been. It really should have been. But, you know, this is what it was really like. That years later, when a corporate type, Kirk Kerkorian, owned the Flamingo and made his first report of his earnings, the state hauled him in and said, what are you doing? We've never seen this much money come out of the Flamingo. And it finally hit everybody. You know, Kerkorian wasn't skimming. So I shudder to think what the actual numbers were.
I can only imagine. There were legal troubles in the 1970s. There was mob involvement at that time as well. But what did that look like?
Well, the Tropicana was an odd one in that it started out as mob controlled. And then the mob didn't run it well. And locals came in and they ran it. And eventually, those who were in charge, it was the Housels family, J. Kel Housel Sr. and Jr., sold to somebody who then sold to somebody. And by the late 70s, the owner was a chemical heiress named Mitzi Stauffer Briggs in Stauffer Chemical. And she really didn't know anything about gambling, and she was just involved. And the Kansas City mob had gotten in on the action through some loans with the Teamsters and some other means. And it turned out that one of the guys in the casino named Carl Thomas, who everybody had been holding up as the new breed, he was clean. And when they were investigating the Kansas City mob and had wiretaps, they got a wiretap of Thomas explaining how to skim to the Kansas City mob bosses. Then the guy who produced the show in the showroom, the Folie Bergère, the ostensible producer, was named Joe Augusto, which was actually a name he had taken to hide his background, which was, in fact, mob all the way. This Augusto character had actually been clean. And Augusto's job was to help keep an eye on things, make sure the skim operated. And the wiretaps that I mentioned essentially enabled federal officials to find out what was really going on with the skimming. And so they are indicting people, state officials force them out, and the Tropicana becomes a corporate-owned hotel casino in the early 80s, which is the time really you see the mob driven out of power in the Las Vegas casinos.
From our archives, that was Michael Green, University of Las Vegas historian and Mob Museum board member, reflecting on the history of the Tropicana Hotel, which closed its doors for good today. When residents moved into Kelowna's Hadgraft Wilson Place last year, they were thrilled. Now they're worried they might never be allowed back in. Officials are evacuating the affordable living residents because of significant safety concerns raised during the construction of a new University of BC Okanagan campus nearby. The more than 80 people who live there have until 6 p.m. local time to vacate the building, which is managed by Pathways Abilities Society. David Cowan lives on the building's fourth floor. That's where we reached him earlier today.
David, how much notice did you get that you would have to leave?
Well, I was actually out. It was Easter evening, and I just came back from dinner with my parents, and somebody was standing outside the building, and she was like, "Did you hear the news? We have to evacuate." They put an official evacuation on. So it's been 48 hours. Yeah. Well,
that's quite an Easter gift.
My word, yeah.
We reached you, I think, as you're just gathering up all of your things and packing up.
Oh yeah. I'm kind of right in the middle of feeling the weight and stress of having to do something so suddenly. But I do see the silver lining. It doesn't hurt to go to a hotel with a pool and not too negative about it.
And who's covering the costs?
I don't know all the, who's paying for what, but I do know that they're paying for the hotel, and they're slated till next week, Friday.
So you know that you'll be covered for a week. When might you be able to come back?
I have no idea. Honestly, that's the biggest stressor, I think, for a lot of people is, as far as information goes, I think they're just estimating a week, but maybe the inside crew will see there's more time required, and I think a lot of people are thinking the worst just because of fear, what's the worst that could happen? And we're afraid we may lose our stuff permanently. So some people are thinking like, do I need to get a storage unit? Do I need to put my stuff somewhere safe? Me, I don't really like to assume. It's just, I'm just going to go with the flow.
Yeah. There's a range. So part of what's happening here is that nearby, a 43-story building, a tower for the University of BC Okanagan, it is going up. Other buildings have been impacted.
Correct.
Like your building has. People have had to move. As that building construction got underway, did you have concerns about your home?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the thing about me is I have a long-term disability and some mental health issues as well. I tend to take life a little bit slower. I was born with a chronic condition, immune system disorder. And so I think that was also part of what kind of got me in here is it's designed to be a community for people who really need it. And so in my case, when I saw the construction was going next door, I didn't think anything of it until I went down to the first floor and saw my friend had basically the building had kind of shifted and the frame on the door was holding the door shut so she couldn't open to her patio. And I thought, that's very unsafe. Like, what if the place is on fire and she can't leave through the front door and the door is jammed because of the building construction being that's probably the worst case scenario in terms of the damage, in terms of safety. So, but for me, all I felt was the tremors.
How long have you felt the tremors?
Oh, every day. I mean, I'm here because I don't work. Trying to get set up to get a part-time job and be assisted by benefits. And that's part of my own experience. So because of that, I've been home pretty much all the time and feeling just shaking like constantly. And that's why there's so many cracks, because it's essentially like a Jenga tower. You know, if the table under the Jenga tower is moving slightly, all the little pieces are going to shift like a millimeter, a centimeter. And that just happened enough that there's cracks all along the hallway, all along the building. So that's been my experience.
What would you have to hear to feel safe coming back to the building?
Oh, my goodness. Well, definitely knowing that it's not going to collapse. We've been reassured that's not the case. That's just kind of like the worst case possibility. So for me, I don't believe that's going to happen. So I do feel safe coming back. I mean, honestly, Pathways has got our back 100%. The building manager is an angel. Like, just the fact that he would plan for something like this to really help people who are disabled is really an amazing gesture.
That's the Pathways,
in and of itself, right?
The Pathways Ability Society, and they have said that they've raised issues with UBC Trust, with the UBC Trust for months now. Leslie Cormack is principal and deputy vice chancellor for UBC Okanagan. She spoke to our colleagues earlier today at Daybreak Kelowna. We'll just play a little bit of that.
There have been a number of subsidiary geotechnical and structural engineering work that's been done both on the site and on the building. I think that it has been interesting to see that there are different opinions, which is why the city asked for peer reviewing of all of the material going forward. I think starting today, the city is bringing together different engineers, different structural experts to really try and figure out what has happened and what's the best path forward.
What do you make of her response, David?
Well, I mean, it's pretty cryptic and vague, not to be, you know, salty or anything. But from my vantage point, I can see really the issue is they've just dug too far down. So I think they'll probably just end up canceling the dig and figure out how to, you know, restructure the building from the foundation. That's likely the only solution, in my opinion. But I mean, obviously, I'm not the engineer.
So lots of questions and investigations still to be done. You have a short-term solution, a hotel that's paid for, as you've said. There, some of your neighbors, you know, have experienced homelessness before, and I wonder what they're telling you about the uncertainty.
Oh my goodness! Well, this is really putting them into a tailspin. I have been homeless myself twice for a short period of time, sort of in transition. But I've talked to a few people and they think like, well, if I lose this place, what am I going to do? Like, I can't go back to Cornerstone, which is a shelter here, or I can't go back to the Gospel Mission. And for them, I think they've had enough and they finally found their peace. They finally found something that centers them, which is to have a home. If you lose that again, I mean, who knows what you're thinking about after that, right? I mean, a lot of us are just living on assistance. So being dependent on that income is also another stressor, right?
Well, David, I hope you all get some answers and some clarity soon. Thank you for your time.
My goodness, thank you so much for the call, and I appreciate your time as well.
David Cowan is one of more than 80 residents of Kelowna's Hadgraft Wilson Place who have had to leave that building after officials raised safety concerns. We reached him at home earlier today. It's been months since a shipwreck washed up off Newfoundland's west coast, but the vessel's past and future are still both mostly a mystery. The wreck appeared off the community of Cape Ray in January. And since then, volunteers have been working against the clock to get it out of the water. On the weekend, they succeeded, but what happens next will be a whole new challenge. Sean Bath was part of that group of volunteers. We reached him in Bay Roberts, Newfoundland and Labrador.
Sean, you've been working on this with others, of course, for weeks now. What did it take in the end to bring this ship to shore?
The thing that got the ship ashore was the heavy lift equipment that was provided by Marine Contractors, Inc. That made all the difference in the world. Yeah. Prior to that, we were just basically tying ropes on the ship, hoping for the best, right?
Yeah. And in the end, what was it like after all this time to get it done?
Well, it was super exciting, to say the least. I mean, how often do you get to work on a project of this magnitude, right?
Yeah.
And we started this and we finished it, or at least phase one. We finished it, Joe Osman, Ann Osman, Bert Osman, Trevor Croft, and myself. And there was Antonio, there was other volunteers. And it was pretty exciting, I must say.
You guys had to fundraise to make that happen, right?
I'm not sure about the details on the equipment yet, what it cost, but we've been fundraising for the whole process, meaning for gas and possibly for the equipment. And like once this is up out of the water now and carried up to the lighthouse, there's a building's got to be built, and there's a whole lot of stuff got to be done to preserve this, right? So they're going to be continuing to fundraise for a while yet,
yeah,
to get the money to do this, right?
You mentioned how rare this is, but you're not from Cape Ray yourself. You wanted to get involved anyway. Why did you want to do that?
We were over in Port of Ash for almost the last 2 years now, cleaning up behind Fiona.
Mm-hmm.
And since we've been over there, like, the people of that area, from Cape Ray to Rose Blanche, they've been providing us with gas, propane, food, whatever you can... whatever we needed. I mean, these people stepped up and provided for us, right? Because they know we're over there. We're not getting paid to do what we do. We're just fundraising. So all the communities came together to help us out, right? And once the ship came ashore, they put the call out to have some divers to come and help them secure it. And we thought it was a perfect opportunity for us to repay the kindness that these people have shown us, right? And so, of course, we jumped on the opportunity.
So it was a way to say thank you.
Absolutely.
So it's in a parking lot now, the ship is, but archaeologists with the province have said the wreck is likely from the 1800s. We know it's old, but they also say that it's likely not historically significant. How does that impact the find in your mind?
It doesn't really, because to the people of Cape Ray and the surrounding area, this is the only time that a ship has ever washed ashore, anything of that size anyhow, and it's got international attention. To me, that makes it significant enough for these people. And pretty much everyone we talked to felt the same way, that it was a significant event for it to come ashore, and they want it preserved so that other people can see it, right? When you get next to this ship and you see the size timbers and the size materials in that and the kind of material that we use, I mean, it may, like, these guys are experts. They know more about shipwrecks than I do, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a pretty significant thing, right? It's not something you see built anymore. I mean, the way they built it, the material they use, is just something you don't see anymore, right?
Not having that designation as something of historical significance, you know, the preservation, the housing of it, all those sorts of things. Is Cape Ray going to be able to do that on its own? Is there enough community interest and support?
I don't think Cape Ray is going to be able to do it on their own, but between us and everybody who's following this story and donating to the cause, I think it will happen, right?
What's your dream for it? What would you like to see happen?
Well, I want to see it up on the hill by the lighthouse where they had planned, where they're planning on putting it, and see a building put around it so that people can go in and see and understand what we see every day, right? Because it is a pretty exciting thing when you stand up next to a ship with timbers there, it's like bigger round in your body, right?
Yeah.
I mean, most ships that's been built back then, especially here in Newfoundland, was not built with material that big, right?
You mentioned you already knew in the aftermath of Fiona how kind and generous the people there could be. What have you learned about the community since you've been working with them on this?
Well, like most any small community here in Newfoundland, you get the vast majority of people pulling together, cooking meals or doing whatever to help with the cause. Now, there's always a few naysayers and try to run people down or put the project down or whatever, but we don't listen to those kind of people.
You did what you set out to do.
We started with a goal in mind to get it out of the water. Unfortunately, it took a little longer than what we had planned. And rather than getting up in one big piece, we had to cut it in three sections. But that wasn't a big deal because when we got it up on the shore, if we'd have got it up in one piece, we had to cut it in sections anyhow because they only need a certain percentage of that ship for the displays, right?
Yeah.
So we just had to measure it up in the water and cut it down there to make it easier to lift, right?
Yeah. Do you know what it's called or what it was called or have you guys named it?
No, we don't know the name of the ship yet. That's the thing for me, like, to have someone in government to make an announcement that the ship has no historical significance without knowing where the ship came from, the name of the ship, or what she was used for, or anything, right? How do you say that, right? How do you say something's got no historical significance when you don't know anything about it?
What do you think it will mean to Cape Ray if they are able to preserve it and house it in the way that you'd like?
I think in the long term, it's going to bring in a lot of tourists to see it. There's people all over the world following this. We've had people from Australia, everywhere, like, sending us messages that, right, wanting to know when this is going to be available to view, right?
Why do you think so many people, even that far away, are interested in this?
I don't know what captivated people, but it just did. Maybe it's because it was a small town it washed in. I don't know, but the response from the people internationally has been amazing, right?
The mystery of it all is probably attractive to people, too.
I guess so, yeah.
Sean, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sean Bath is the founder of Clean Harbors Initiative. We reached him in Bay Roberts, Newfoundland and Labrador. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app, or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.